Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Susan Eyrich. A licensed psychologist, biologist, and educator, Susan has taught at universities around the world, worked in maximum security prisons, developed a university counseling center, directed a nature conservancy preserve, and lived in remote corners of Nepal, the Mid and Far East, the Northwest Territories, and the Amazon rainforest. Her goal is always to see through others' eyes as a way to enhance understanding between cultures, peoples, and species. She founded Earthfire Institute, Wildlife Sanctuary and Retreat Center in 2000 in order to give a voice to wildlife and help people find their own natural voice. Earthfire's mission is to help humans change how they see and therefore treat wildlife and nature. Susan lives with these animals throughout their lifetimes, developing deep relationships and insights. This makes it possible for her to bring wild animals' voices into our awareness and into conservation decisions. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
My pleasure, Derek.
So what is the Earthfire Institute, and how did it form?
It's a wildlife sanctuary located just a couple of miles west of Grand Teton National Park on the Idaho border with Wyoming. And we have native animals, animals that are native to the Yellowstone to Yukon Wildlife Corridor, some of whom can never be free. We also have rehabilitation for those who can. And so we form really deep relationships with these animals, some of them over their entire lifetime. And I've had the utter privilege of getting to know them and see them on an intimate basis. These are bears and wolves and bison and foxes and coyotes and badgers and porcupines. And the opportunity to spend time with them and to get to know them like you can't in the wild and you can't in a zoo has led to some incredible insights. And I really had no idea about much of this when I started it. And it's just been a constant journey for me. Learning. Go ahead.
So how did it start? How did this whole institution form in the first place?
Well, I've loved animals ever since I could remember coming into consciousness. And I, for some reason, loved wolves in particular, even though I'd never met one. I have no idea why. Then I fell in love with a cat when I was in my early 20s, I would say. And that love was just so deep. I had never felt anything like it. And it kind of just opened me. Then I met someone some years later. Then I met someone a few years later who was training animals for movies. And he had come upon some wolf puppies that he had to rescue from a movie set. And he asked me to help raise them. And they were very young. And, you know, who's going to say no to that? And as I was bottle feeding them, and they all got terribly ill, and we had to take care of them morning and night, 24 hours a day, with IVs every couple of hours because they were so dehydrated. They all lived. Then the process of feeding them and nurturing them and wanting them to live, and they did live, I fell so hopelessly, deeply in love. It was like nothing I'd ever felt before, even with the cat. And a woman who was a friend of mine came down and said, "You know what happened to you, Susan?" I said, "No." She said, "Motherhood." And it's true, they weren't my children, but the bond was so tight, I swear I could feel the oxytocin racing in my blood. And I would have done anything for those puppies. And it meant I began to really connect and understand to them. There were seven puppies, seven entirely different personalities, and the beauty and the passion to live and just who they were. I said, you know, I've got to share this with other people, this type of intimacy. And because of that, and the person who was training animals for movies and I decided he wanted to give back to animals, too. He trained wild animals, only with reward. We decided that we really needed to start a place where we could give animals a life who might not have one otherwise and share who they were with other people. He, in particular, was able to handle them because that was his profession, to handle wild animals. So I could do the education, and he could help handle them for people to actually meet them. So when they come here, and we only let a few people come at a time, four retreats over a period of time, because it's not a zoo. It's not a place for people to come for interest or healing, even though they would be healed when they come. It's a place for the animals and for humans and animals to begin to meet in a way that they can't anywhere else and to begin to try to understand one another. And what's really interesting is the animals here are actually eager to meet people. Again, we only have a few people a year because it is an intense experience and I don't want to overwhelm the animals. And then what I can do is I can write about it, film it, and share it with people online. The fundamental thing I want to share is that there's this incredible beauty on this earth for us and with us. And it's not a lose-lose. It's a win-win if we save a place for them to live, apart from the sheer biology of it, that if we save a place for them, it's for us too, and for the whole ecological systems. But the exquisite beauty of what's on this earth with us, and if we can connect to it, I mean, it does heal us. We begin to understand the connection. The animals serve as a portal into all of life, so that once you begin to realize you can have a bond with a wolf or a bear or a coyote or any animal, it begins to open you towards, wait a minute, maybe it's true of all life. Maybe all life is intelligent. Maybe all life wants to connect. And my experience over time is I do believe that all life recognizes life and recognizes it with joy and is fascinated by it. Just like a kid draws, automatically crawls towards any animal. I think it's not as vivid for us with a tree or a plant, but I really feel when you go into a forest, if you go in with respect, I think we're welcomed. I think they welcome us. And how can we learn how to live like that? That's my job.
Well, I was going to ask how the animals there manifest their eagerness or anticipation of having human guests. But I want to hold off on that for a second. And no, let's go ahead and go there. So how do they manifest this?
Okay, so to begin with, if anyone wants to come here, I make it a little difficult. I think this is not a place for you, for humans. It's a place for the animals because there's few enough places in the world for them, and they're other places you can go for human healing. But if you want to genuinely connect with an idea of trying to help and give back, then you're welcome. And then I send a little information to them about how to be with the animals, that what to expect, how not to talk constantly when you're here, because then you're not connecting. So I send them a bunch of instructions. So everybody who comes is prepared. Nobody can come for a quick visit. It's just not, I just don't let them. So, for instance, if we do a retreat, sometimes we do different types of retreats, but every single time we have a retreat, Bluebell, our bison, she has 30 acres to roam in, is right there. And then it's right against the fence. And then if she comes trotting over or ambling over, depending on her mood and the heat and whether she's just eaten or not. But she comes over, leans against the fence and says, give me good energy. Because a lot of the people who come here are people who are into animals, and many of them have healing hands, and she's come to expect it. And she comes to demand it. And she will stay there as long as people are giving her healing energy. And then Nima, a white buffalo that was given to us by a Native American, comes over, and she's a little subservient to the very dominant Bluebell. And she comes behind Bluebell and hangs her head over it, trying to receive the energy through Bluebell. Unless Bluebell is distracted enough, and then Nima can come and get her own. So we had another group of people. So all the animals, when people come up to the people. Okay, they're not hiding, they're not running away, they come up. Obviously, there's safety things in place and all that. We had a retreat once where I was trying to get people, it didn't work really well, but I was trying to get people who were leaders in the field, but they were more environmentally traditional, perhaps. So it didn't work the way I wanted it to. But one of the people I had invited was an artist, and he was great. And he had a little ukulele. And we let one of our bears into the bear garden, where there's a pool. This is Teton Totem, a very remarkable grizzly bear. And Billy was playing his ukulele. And people were sitting, and it was sunny, and they were sitting. And the way we have it set up, you can be like 1 foot from the bear because there's fencing and electric wiring, but he can come right up to it. So he can be very, very close if he chooses. And he did choose. And he came over, and everybody was lying there, and it was beautiful and peaceful, and he came right up to the fence. And Billy was playing the ukulele, and Teton was swaying back and forth, and it was just like this magical moment. The wolves come up to greet people. They come up to greet you.
So how did... I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's just my bottom line answer.
So how do most of the creatures who end up there, how do they end up there?
Many different ways. Shomu, our porcupine, was found clinging to her dead body's mother, her mother's dead body in the middle of a road who'd been hit, and someone picked her up and handled her and bottle fed her till she was too bonded and couldn't be released. Humble Bumble Bear, he's named that way because it's a long story. But he came from a roadside zoo that was closed. A couple of our cougars came from a woman who bred them and thought they were cute when they were little and discovered that they weren't so cute when they got bigger. The same with a couple of our black bears. Bluebell the bison came from a game farm where she actually would have been meat, but her mother didn't want to raise her and the people didn't want to take the trouble. Runs Like the Wind was a three-legged deer who couldn't be released back into the wild. Various stories of injuries or orphanage, being orphaned or being bred in captivity, and then the people realized they couldn't handle them.
So I want to thank you for doing that work, because I think it's so important to help to rescue creatures who help to give creatures who have been put in roadside zoos or for whatever reason can't live their normal lives. I think it's really wonderful that you give them a life, that you help them to have a happy life, I should say.
You could say that, but what they give back is such great, much, much more measure. The love, the intelligence, the interest, the education they give us. Teton Totem. Go ahead, you want to ask me something?
No, go ahead, please.
Teton Totem is a grizzly bear. He's about 20 now. And something happened to him. We don't know what, but he was... After we got him, we don't know what happened, but somehow he was no longer able to walk. And the vet came and said, well, what are you going to do with a 1,000-pound grizzly bear? Put him down. We said, no way in hell. The look in his eye was alive. He was embarrassed. He was, about not being able to walk. It was like very undignified. He's this magnificent male bear. I said, no way in hell. So I called a friend of mine who does telepathic animal communication and just what can we do? Is there nutrition, anything? And she said, let me see what I could do. This is long distance. And these are one of the things that kind of blew me away, because all I knew was I loved the bear. I wasn't going to let him die. And if there was anything in hell I could do for him to not be paralyzed, I was going to do it. And I didn't care if it was inside my belief system, outside my belief system, I was going to try it. So I called her, and from a long distance, she was in Arizona at the time, she'd met him. She said, let me see what I can do. And then called back a couple of days later and said, any difference? And I said, well, actually, kind of. He kind of crawled over to the pool and tried to drop his right hind leg in it and move it, but could be a coincidence. And over time, as she worked on him, this is in September, by November, that bear was walking. Now, I can't tell you how. I can't tell you why. I can only tell you that he was. And this was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and he's still walking. I asked her what she did, and she said she can sort of do a scan, and she scanned down his body and felt in the bottom of his spine, at the base of it, that it was both compressed and a disc was out. and that she tried to give him the indication that he might be able to move it back in. That's what she said she did. He went to sleep for the hibernation, and I was worried because was he going to be arthritic? Was he still going to be okay after sleeping for several months? He came out, and he was utterly sweet. And he was so sweet that, again, I had no idea about any of this, but people who had come to visit sometimes would stand in front of him and start to cry. And they would cry from the utter sweetness in his face. And this had not been before the injury. He'd been a typical bear. So I don't know what happened. I can only tell you the facts of what happened. And that since then, spontaneously, without my saying anything about it, people who met him would be unable to tear themselves away. So what does that mean? And I had another wolf who had this temper to her brain, which is 100% fatal, supposedly, but she didn't die. And then she had all these symptoms afterwards. You know, her eyes were crossed and she couldn't walk straight. And the vet said, again, there's nothing you can do. You can give her prednisone, but that's it. And again, I couldn't bear it. This is this beautiful, beautiful, sweet wolf. And I asked a friend of mine who does craniosacral work, or work on the nervous systems of paralyzed humans. And I asked her to come. And this is a video that you can see on YouTube. And I have some video footage of Teton also, actually, because the stories are so unbelievable. So we brought her to our yurt. She'd never been there in the yurt before. The wolf's name was Apricot. And Jill started to work on her. And within a few minutes, that wolf, who'd never been in a yurt, who'd never met Jill, settled in and went into this deep, deep healing trance. And I took a camera and put it right in her, right close to her face. You can see her eyes. You can see her going into the trance. And after maybe 45 minutes, I'm doing a very abbreviated version here, she got up, shook herself, and she wasn't cured or anything. But something had shifted. She was bright-eyed, and it was like she had hope. And over a period of several months, Jill would come again, and she healed completely. To the extent when she was 12, she leapt off the top of our waterfall 15 feet into a pool below to get a piece of meat. So that this is on video. How did that happen? That a wolf recognized what she was offering, the energetic healing. And so I began to realize how responsive they are to energy and what that means for the energy they're in when we're around, all of the implications of that positive energy and negative energy. And there's just one story after another, because I did have time to spend with these animals, of entering into going through a portal, I guess, and entering into awareness of who they are, how responsive they are. I don't know who they are, but a little more of who they are, what their capacities are, how they end up being healed the same way that we're healed. When I showed the video of Apricot going into a healing trance to a Tibetan Buddhist teacher friend of mine, he said, "That's the exact same look that I see in teachers, Buddhist teachers, when they go into deep meditation." So the implication to me, coming from my more biological background, was, wow, does that mean that wolves and people go to the same deep place for healing and meditation? Is it the same source? So those connections started to be drawn for me, and that's what I want to share with people, the little bit that I do know.
So how does, can you tell some of the other, oh wait, actually before I ask that, this makes me think of a line that I read in a silly fantasy novel when I was a teenager that has always stuck with me. And the line was, "The God will not speak to those who have no time to listen." And I've thought about that in terms of, for example, writing, that, you know, the muse won't speak to you if you don't have the time to listen. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the relationship between spending prodigious amounts of time with non-humans and getting to know them.
Was there more to that question? Was that the question? Just talk about it?
Oh, yeah. That's the question. It's just, can you talk about the relationship between It's just become really clear to me, you know, I've lived on the same land for 20 years, and it takes time to develop a relationship, especially with someone who doesn't speak, not only doesn't speak English, but might not actually speak human, but in fact doesn't speak human, you know, may speak animal or may speak tree, that takes time. So can you talk about the relationship between time and getting to know non-humans, and that's all. Just the relationship between time and getting to know them.
I think time is essential, but even more, it's slowing down and entering into a different mental space where you can receive. So if you spend a lot of time with an animal, that gives the opportunity, or a plant, that gives the opportunity for it to happen. But you also have to be internally slowed down and opened up to be able to receive. One of the great tragedies of our time is how rushed everyone is and how distracted and unable to listen to their own inner wisdom, let alone any other beings. That would take us out of our misery and our franticness and our rushness into understanding not just the interconnectedness that we have with other living beings, but the exquisite joy of it and the healing quality of it and the meaning it gives life. And we can't do that if we're rushing. And it's the exact opposite of everything that's happening. I don't know what's going to happen. If somehow, you know, when things go to one extreme, maybe they go back to another. With all the craziness that goes on now with online, how do you help people get to go online, which is part of where I try to do my teaching, to get people to slow down when there's all this crazy noise around it? It's a real problem. It's a major problem if we don't allow ourselves to breathe and feel the earth and feel what it's saying to us in its own way.
So, I mean, obviously both you and I have problems with human supremacism, and this might not be a fair question, but what do you say to somebody who would go, a porcupine having something to teach me? Are you kidding? It's just a stupid creature with a bunch of prickles. So how do you just ignore people like that, or do you actually, or is there a response to somebody who is that dismissive of non-human beingness?
It isn't really a fair question, because I would do it in, I think the way I respond would be to an individual rather than an abstract question like that. I might feel from the individual, is there a way in somehow. Do you have a dog? Most people do. Or a cat? And I might try to help them start to connect to something that they do know, because it's such a, the problem is the gap between their world and the fact of what a porcupine is. I mean, just try and take a juicy pear away from a porcupine and you learn about their character very quickly.
Sorry, go ahead, please. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so I'm not sure you can do it in the abstract, to answer your question, Derek. I think it might have to be on a person-to-person basis, feeling with that person how you might find a way to, it's like a closed part of the brain. How do you sort of reach in somehow with a story or something else, a connection, to begin to open it? To begin to open, let some space in there, let them begin to see another point of view a bit. So I guess that's my answer.
So what or who is a porcupine?
Now that question alone isn't actually accurate. So what do you mean a porcupine? How would you answer what is or what is a human? Every single human is different. So I can't tell you what a porcupine is. I mean, there are certain general qualities of porcupines, and there are certain general qualities of humans, and there are certain general qualities of wolves, so we could talk in generalities. But that takes us out of the immediacy into an abstract. Now I can tell you about a particular porcupine. And yes, she has all the qualities, general qualities of a porcupine, 30,000 quills and stubborn. I think they're all stubborn. That I know of, that I've ever met. But then the particular qualities of each one. So the Shomi, I could pick that 40-pound porcupine up and walk around with her. And I could let kids pet her. And I was mentioning before, she loved pears. Now, the next porcupine I had did not like pears. But if you tried to take a pear away from Shomi, one time, the pears are big and heavy, and porcupines aren't that big, and I gave her a juicy pear, and it looked like she was having trouble eating it, and I reached over to try and hold it for her, and the scream she gave set me jumping back 30 feet. That's utter outrage, because she thought I was trying to take it away. Or we would go for walks, porcupine walks, which are not very fast, as you might imagine. And we'd walk along, and then she'd just fall asleep. And then she'd wake up, and then she'd climb a tree, and then she wouldn't come down. So it's, and it was not the same with another one, so I can't, the biggest, when you ask me what earth fire is, another thing I would say is, other than the mysterious stories of the connection that's possible when an animal is in need and we're open and we want to heal it, is how profoundly individual they are. Every single being in my mind is an individual expression of the universe. And is, and where we get lost is trying to generalize. Not that generalizations aren't important and useful, but we lose sight of the specific being.
Well, I think that's a hugely important point, because when we think about a herd of buffalo or we think about a school of fish, it can be easy to just sort of picture the whole bunch as a some sort of stereotype that we're projecting onto them. But the truth is, every one of those buffalo is an individual who has preferences and has, I mean, it's like a friend of mine loves prairie dogs and knows a lot about them. And she will talk about how, for example, if there's a threat to the prairie dogs, like if there's a bird of prey flies overhead, then it's okay for everybody to jump into whatever burrow is closest. But if, under normal circumstances, it would be a tremendous breach of etiquette for me to jump into your burrow without permission. And so, and that, of course, the prairie dogs have friends, they have enemies, they have prairie dogs they don't like very much. And this is, you know, true for schools of fish, it's true for flocks of birds, it's true for everybody.
Yeah, a guy called, I think it was Colin somebody, wrote a book called A Walk Through, A Man Walks Through Time. I believe he was walking through the Grand Canyon. And one day he was lying on a beach, just spending time there, actually. And he noticed these little sand fleas flying. And as he observed them, because he had a lot of time, he was this walk, the man who walked through time with a lot of time. And he observed them, and he saw after a while that they were actually in a territory, that they sort of kept within sort of a square, so to speak. And some of them were more adventurous, and some of them were shyer. And he began to think that insects are individuals too. And I think it's true that every single being that comes into life is unique, and a particular expression of the universe is, or whatever word you want to use, intelligence, a creative expression. And that also each of us is, just as I'm aware of myself and you're aware of yourself, and I believe I am me and you believe you are you, among other things, I think there's that sense somehow, may not be as conscious, but there's that sense somehow of each life form's own beingness and own ability to express itself in its own unique way. And what a world that is to live in, Derek. If you think of the richness of everything around you wanted to express itself to its fullest tree-ness, and I wouldn't want to say tree-ness, but willowness, but then willow is a particular species, that particular willow wanting to express itself in this particular shape. I mean, what an incredible symphony. You know, Bernie Krause's work where he talks about if you go to an ecological system that's not been disturbed, how every single acoustic niche is filled. There isn't any space that's not filled, and none of them interfere with one another. And then when he goes back and it's been supposedly selectively cut, say, so that in theory it's we did a good job, it's like dead. There's no sound left. But the beauty that we can sense when we're in a true wilderness. I went in a horseback trip with a friend of mine, Wayne Sawchuk, who almost single-handedly saved a whole section of the northern British Columbia. Just wilderness. No tracks. Satellite just didn't work. Nobody for I don't know how far, how long. And the feeling there was just this humming, beautiful, beautiful harmonious resonance. Not that animals didn't die and get eaten, but the whole was just exquisite. And it's something you can't even get here in the national park because it's already been so disrupted, beautiful as it is where I live. And if only we can get aware of that, the beauty that's available for us, the healing, the joy, the meaning. I keep saying it over and over again, but it's just true. And the animals arising from the earth in their own magnificence, because they do come from the earth. We don't create them.
So I'm thinking a couple things. One of them is that my mom had a very long and beautiful relationship with bears, and the mother bears would bring their babies up to show her, and we saw generation after generation of bears.
Wow.
And one of the things that always struck me, and this is exactly what you're saying about every bear being different, that so often when there would be a set of twins, for example, it was quite often the case that one of them was fairly adventurous and fairly mischievous, and the other one was much shyer. And the other one, the mischievous one, was also much more aggressive in almost every way. And this was not sex-based, that it could be a little female who's really adventurous and could be a male who's very, not very adventurous. And I thought about this for a long time, and, you know, I'm not a big fan of sort of straight mechanistic perspectives, but I did think it was really interesting that this would be a good survival strategy to have.
Yeah.
Under normal circumstances, the one who is more aggressive is going to get more food. But also, the one who is more aggressive is more likely to fall off a tree and die, is more likely to eat poison, is more likely to wander too far away from mom and get killed by somebody. And so it just, even within that mechanistic perspective, which once again, I think both you and I have some problems with, there still is that variation. Or just in a different subject, I was just reading in a book the other day that human sleep patterns, when we like to sleep, whether it's from 8 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning, is probably partly inherent, and partly that has to do with, as hunter-gatherers, it would be important for somebody to be awake all the time. And so it would be natural for some people to be more likely to be awake at night and other people to be more likely awake during the day. And we can say the same thing about non-humans. Presumably, at every step of the way, we can talk about the non-human variation, and it's crazy that we even have to defend the fact that individual non-humans would be individuals with preferences and personalities.
Yeah. So, oblivious. Rather than crazy, maybe it's oblivious. Like the person who says, what's a porcupine? When I get back to that thought, I might tell that person a story about a porcupine to try to bring the reality of it home to that person. It's another way I might try to handle it. But there is a validity to the mechanistic point of view. It's just extremely limiting and reducing. It takes all the wonder out of the world. The many other levels of reality too. Just having to get stuck in that one in our particular culture.
So what would be, you mentioned early on some of the lessons that the animals have taught you. Are there some more stories and or lessons that you want to tell to listeners?
There was the underlying theme is the same, that we're all interconnected and we all respond similarly. I had a beautiful, 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 delicate coyote. I actually had five coyotes, and every single one of them dramatically different personalities. I mean, one Pimpernel, her personality was, she filled whatever space she was in. She had total confidence. For example, another one, Fairy Tale, the one I'm talking about, was just a shy, delicate, exquisite female, feminine, female. And I don't know what happened to her. She and her brother came to us in utter terror. And she never completely came out of it, but she had such courage. She wanted to connect, and she would try to, and then the terror would pull her back again. And I thought, you know, animals, of course, they can have PTSD just like us. And I don't know if she had it specifically, or if all the horrible things we've done over so many generations to coyotes have, as with people, trauma is intergenerational. Was she carrying it somehow? And some beings more sensitive than others carry it more than others. Others seem to be impervious to it. But she was so beautiful, and I wanted her to have a good life. And we had some friends come. It was Donna Eden, who's an energy healer, and her husband, who does emotional freedom technique on Vietnam vets and vets in general. And I said, you know, try. Now, he couldn't connect with her because she wouldn't let anybody touch her. So she was in her enclosure, but he did it sort of using his own body as a connection. And he would tap on the meridians of terror. And I have this on footage too. And she calmed down. So my fundamental, most fundamental thing, question, not question, lesson is they're tuned to something that we're tuned to. And we can connect with them on that level. That's one thing. I think animals want to connect with us if fear weren't in the way, just like we want to connect with them. It's no different because we're the same on an emotional level. Our brains are structured the same, that we're fascinated by one another if fear weren't in the way. And one of the things that the advantages I have is here, the animals can be fascinated without the fear because they know they're safe. And then these other things happen that kind of broaden your sense of what life is and how we can be connected with it. And even if we never can go out in the wilderness or meet a bear or meet a wolf, it begins us, helps us to begin to think that maybe we can connect to our goldfish or to a gopher or to a rabbit. But obviously we can connect to our dogs and cats because they're domestic. But that the possibility for connection is everywhere, everywhere. And even if it's just I shouldn't say just a plant, isn't what I mean to say at all, but a plant as well can respond. There's some incredible new research coming out about plant awareness and plant sensitivity. I mean, good hardcore scientific research. Everything is waiting to connect in a positive way at one level. And what a way that is to live, to seek it rather than to destroy it. And what it does, if you want to be practical about it, what that does to our own immune system, let alone sense of joy and meaning.
You know, a statistic that I keep thinking about is that here in Northern California, prior to conquest, if you were near a river, the chances were good that you would see a grizzly bear about every 15 minutes. And that's... I'm saying that in terms of validating what you were saying earlier about having curiosity about each other, that if you live in Northern California and you're near a river and you're seeing a grizzly bear every 4 times an hour, then the chances are pretty good that you're going to get to know these other beings. And it will be an everyday occurrence as opposed to, oh my God, I see a grizzly bear, I need to run, get my gun, or I need to run away as fast as I can. It's just part of life.
Yeah. And we're fascinated by each other.
So you mentioned early on, I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
Go ahead. I said, we're fascinated by each other if we allow it. Yeah, go ahead.
So you said earlier that some of the creatures have been able to be returned to the wild. Can you tell any stories about any of those?
Not really. Because what we try very hard is not to connect with them in a way that they begin to trust humans, because humans, particularly out here in the West where we shoot everything, it's not safe to trust humans. So it's a different kind of world where we try to help them heal medically and then release them where we think they're going to be safe.
And so can you give sort of you've said different creatures, but I'm trying to get a picture of the actual physical location. Can you give a little bit of an inventory of who some of your friends and guests are there now?
Do you want names or species or individuals in the description of each?
Whatever you want to do. I mean, so how much land does the place cover itself?
We have 40 acres, not nearly enough, just all we could manage to afford at the time.
And you've mentioned the one grizzly bear. Is there? I thought you mentioned two grizzly bears. How many bears are there?
We have four grizzly bears and one black bear. We had two black bears, who were brothers, and one of them passed away. And there's the most remarkable story about that too, but I don't know if you want me to take time for that.
Sure.
Or to tell you your question. Okay, so we had two black bear brothers. A woman had raised them thinking they were cute, and then when they got bigger, her husband said no. So they were probably about 6 months when we got them. But they were brothers, and in the winter they would sleep in each other's arms. They would fight like brothers, but they were sleeping in each other's arms all winter. And the major bear got ill. We took him up to Washington State, but they didn't know what to do. And eventually he passed away. And Huckleberry Bear, Bear, his brother, was sad, but we didn't know what to do. And we'd had a retreat of artists students who came for a 3-week period. And one of them, for some reason, she was an artist who was interested in costume, but she was an excellent drawer. She drew really beautifully. But she was from L.A., and she didn't know much about wildlife at all. And she was drawn to sit in front of the area where Huckleberry was. And suddenly, she started to feel sad. She thought, this is weird. And then she felt tears running down her face, and she said, this is really weird. And then she felt, I don't know how you receive things. It's not really words, but the impression, I miss my brother. And she said, this is really, really weird because I don't have a brother. But she felt a sadness and stayed with him and said that she was going to come and visit him every single day as long as she was there. And then he went back into his den. And that evening, around the campfire, when people say things that they might not dare during the day, she said, did Huckleberry have a brother? She didn't know. So somehow that bear was communicating across species to someone who's just sitting there open. And as to your earlier point, she was just giving him the time. She was just sitting there watching him without any expectations or awareness, and it just came into her. And he was communicating the sadness across species. That's what's available for us.
You know, one of the bears, the bear that actually started my mom's relationship with bears, was one that we ended up calling Mama. She raised many, many generations here, and she was the very first one. And her mother had dropped her off outside my mom's house, and my mom at first tried to ignore her, and then after that she tried to yell at her and get her to go away. And the bear was even more stubborn than my mom and basically outlasted her until my mom accepted her. And my mom, it would be, my mom would walk outside and she could call and the bear would come. And there's no fences. The bear's purely wild. And the point is that after 7 or 8 years, you know, mother bears are the ones with the territory and females. And then, she went away. She went to some other territory. And my mom was dying of cancer last summer, and Mama came back.
Yeah.
And how did she know? You know, I don't know how she knew, but she had been gone for 8 years. She came back for a couple of weeks, and my mom said, "Well, either she's coming to, you know, help wish me to get well, or she's coming to say goodbye." And so Mom was here for a couple of weeks and then she left again. And that I'm just validating what you said. That is one of the things that we have lost in this culture, is that those neighborly interactions.
Yeah. And the mysterious that, yes, very much so, the neighborly interactions. One of the things I always try to talk about is the companionship that's available for us. We don't need to be lonely. There's companionship everywhere, beyond humans.
So we have like 2 minutes left. Can you both, and sorry to do this so quickly, but can you convey, you know, sort of the final lesson that you want to do for listeners today, and then also tell them how they can learn more about the Earth Fire Institute?
I don't know if I love the word lessons. It's too educational. It's I don't know what other word to use. Is an unbelievable discovery to go out there for us and healing. I don't know if I could say anything more than what I've already said. I would like to say, what a mystery it was that your mother's bear chose your mother and insisted on it. She wanted a connection. What does that mean? And just, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to live, but I assume right through my death I'm going to be asking these questions, because it's so interesting. Life is just so interesting. I guess that's what I would say. And Earth Fire Institute, we're online. It's all one word, earthfireinstitute.org, nonprofit. We have newsletters every couple of weeks. We'd have online conversations once a month to explore how we can connect differently with Earth Fire, with our Earth, and try to reverse some of the damage we're doing. So check us out online.
Well, thank you so much for what you're doing in the world, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Susan Eyrich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.